I think the first question that occurs to us is, what are human rights? Well, how did I get interested in this? And we'll come back to that question about what are human rights. And I have an overhead because, as you can see, my handwriting's terrible. I have no sense of spatial organization, but I have a good idea about what the area is about. But in terms of my own background, in 1967, I went fishing with my mother out of town. I'm from Newark, New Jersey. And it was in the early summer, right about this time of the year. And while I was out of town, Newark experienced its first major riot. And when we came back into town, there were National Guardsmen lined up all and down the town next, Irvington, New Jersey, next to Newark, and they wouldn't let us go to our home. And they searched our car and they harassed my mother. And that's when it came to me that a good society has to have both order and also a kind of immunity from the action of the state. That is, the state has to maintain a certain level of order. At the same time, the state cannot order citizens in any fashion. And I think that sentiment was deeply impressed upon me in the 6 days of rioting that took place after that particular day, and in the equally deleterious rioting the next year when Martin Luther King was assassinated. And to a certain extent, my life was deeply impressed by recognizing the thin veneer that oftentimes holds a society together, and the rapidity from which a society can go from order to anarchy. Okay. Well, again, what does that have to do with human rights? What are human rights? Now, what I have, since I said I didn't want a sage on the stage presentation, a little sage paper. Those of you who already have paper, that's fine too. And I have pencils for those of you who don't. But really, one of the things you find out about human rights is that it is a field, an area, an understanding that is not subject to one arbitrary, authoritative determination. So, what I'd like to do is to talk a little bit about the history of human rights and the church. And then I'd like us to do a little work together on what we think about human rights. Again, you can see from that passage in Paul that Paul was claiming a right. What he was claiming to was a right not to be beaten prior to having a hearing before a civil magistrate as a member or a citizen of Rome. Okay, that's a civil right Paul is claiming there. Clearly, what's implied in the passage of Scripture is that if Paul were not a Roman citizen, that in fact the beating and the incarceration prior to any kind of hearing might have been not only legal, but there's always implied the notion that it might have also been moral. And of course, what Paul is doing is invoking the power of the state to restrain the state. You know, just don't say we can go after you beat us all night. You know, you come here and let us out because we're Roman citizens. Similarly, Francis J. Grimke, who was born in slavery and who lived until the 1930s, roughly 1937, was trying to communicate to powerful forces in society that citizens, which he was claiming, have both duties and rights. And he was doing so at a time when African Americans could not legally vote in most of the country. In some parts of the country, it was almost impossible to own property. In most of the country, it was impossible or illegal to give testimony against white citizens. And in fact, there was no right for where you might live. And in fact, there was a segregation of jobs. So that you have Grimke claiming rights, clearly at a time when the rights that he might be claiming were not enjoyed by most African Americans. And I think this is, to a certain extent, the history of rights. Rights are claims that are made at a time when there's some understanding of the claiming, but it's not clear that the rights are fully understood. So there's always a certain kind of moral ambiguity to rights. Well, again, if you look in the Bible, you don't find that it talks about human rights. In the Old Testament, when you have prophets, they talk about essentially duties. Duties and virtue. You know, what are we to do, O Israel? We're to keep covenant with Jehovah. There's a variety of covenants. There's a covenant with Abraham, a covenant with Noah, a covenant with David. There comes a new covenant with Jesus Christ. But those covenants emphasize duties, the duties of the individual, the duties of the community, the covenanted community. So that, in fact, you find that rights language, at least in the West, particularly with reference to individuals, tends to be rather modern language. So, where do you find rights really becoming popular in terms of moral usage? After the Enlightenment, we have a long development of Judeo-Christian culture and social relations from Abraham to the Enlightenment. You've got several thousand years. And at that time, moral relations, social relations, and political relations, and how people thought and talked about them are dominated by duty. Did I do my duty? Did you do your duty? Do we as a people do our duty? You see again in the Old Testament, kings are looked upon as being good kings because they did their duty and caused the people to do their duties towards God and towards sojourners and the poor and the widows of the land, or they're bad kings. You see that continuously. Well, I think now is the time for us to hesitate and give you an opportunity. You know, this is one of those where there aren't really wrong answers. I'd like you to define what you think are human rights. And I tell you in advance to your doing so that your answer is as good as anybody else's. What I'm trying to do is to understand your position on this. And the reason why is, in terms of my teaching style, I have what Paulo Freire calls the sharing method rather than the banking method of education. I assume that, not that I have all the education which I deposit in you, but that education is a cooperative, interdependent process. So, if you'd be so kind, just write what you think your definition is of human rights.
Should we limit this to the United States?
However you want to define it. You want to limit it, you limit it. You don't want to, no. See what I'm saying? This is your creativity. Take your time. Go for it. Where are you from?
Eastern Washington, near the Idaho border. A little college town called Pullman.
Okay. And you?
Camp Washington, near Seattle.
I'm from Cambridge, Wisconsin.
I'm from Bellevue, right by Seattle.
Oh, okay. Everybody have a shot? Okay, good, good. Now what I want to do is, I'd like us to spend a little time talking about the sharing, what our definitions are. Again, there is not a right answer, so.
You want me to go first?
I want someone to go first. Someone's always got to bite that bullet.
Human rights, to me, equal the ability to grow and enhance one's life without imposing upon or depriving others of their ability to grow or enhance their life or lives.
Okay, so you focus on the agent and the capacity and opportunity of the agent. Okay, with the social reference. Don't want to impose or restrain or conflict with the rights of others. Okay, how about you?
Well, I put it, my human right is to be able to live in the United States as a citizen and to enjoy the privileges which it offers.
Okay. You focus on the rights within a country and the definition of what those rights might be. Good.
I said human rights is treating all the people equally, resulting in also equal opportunities.
All right. You focus on the notion of human equality. Good.
I said the right to help make decisions about one's daily life and environment and governing, and the right to not be afraid to do.
Okay, so you focused on, as I hear you, on participation in terms of how society is ordered and how one finds oneself in society, and also security, which is very important. That is a certain kind of immunity from people being interfering with one's life and into also interfering in the process of defining corporate life. Very good. These are all very good. And the reason why I can say you're all right is that, in fact, human rights cannot and has not and probably will never have one agreed upon, non-contested, non-controversial, definition. And in fact, what most human rights discourse, that is discussion, is about is the definition. So that what I wanted to illustrate with this is that you can have many different definitions. I think all of them vary somewhat. And yet, in fact, there can be a substantial amount of agreement and yet a substantial amount of variation. Well, in terms of my understanding of human rights and my definition, that's not necessarily better than anyone else, but I like to focus on the notion of human rights being moral rights that belong to everyone as a member of God's inclusive covenant. Okay? Now, my own background, again, is I'm a theological ethicist, means that for me, moral language, moral analysis, discourse has to involve discussion about a creator God. So that I understand human beings as being created by God, created in community. And in what Joseph L. Allen calls an inclusive community, which I think is a helpful understanding of covenant. By inclusive community, Allen means that all human beings are created in the image of God, created to be in a covenant community, and that whatever rights there are that are human rights are given to people because of their being created as human beings. Not because they're Christians or any other religion, but because they're created by one God. And I like that personally because of the fact it's both universal, it's international, and because of the fact that it doesn't get into issues of a person having to earn their rights or anything like that. So that's just one kind of definition. The other thing I like about it, that you see under subheading 3.2, is that it's rooted in the relationship between humanity and God as opposed to between human and human. You know, the validity of human rights comes from God. Again, I say that as a confession. I don't expect everybody to believe in God. I do. And I expect that most folks that hold them do. And what it does, I believe, is that rights discourse is just another way that God has made for people to relate to each other. I want to cut this off because I think sometimes these overheads, while they are good, they can also be distracting. In other words, what I'm trying to say is that God has created human beings to live in community, in covenant, and in order. And that human beings have oftentimes put together a variety of ways of doing that. Thus, when people say that human rights are universal and go across all periods of time, I don't think they have that quite right. What I think is true is that what we call rights are another way of describing constraints on human behavior. So that, as you put it, you know, you can realize yourself as an agent in life, but you have to be careful about interfering with others. So, you don't find human rights language in the Old Testament. And in fact, as we describe rights, which we describe primarily as claims, you don't find it in a lot of human society, particularly in certain Asian traditions, in Japan and in China, because they're primarily, as we would say, in the West, communitarian societies in which individual rights claiming is submerged very much under an understanding of people as being members of a community and of having community or communitarian duties, that word duties, which is the older word, rather than rights. Well, I want to turn to that and spend a little time again. What duties must we fulfill to uphold human rights? And what I would like you to do in answering that kind of question is to think about yourself as a member of God's inclusive covenant. That is, you're a human being, created in the image of God, and you're trying to answer what duties might you have to perform for that recognition to be extended to everyone, including yourself. Here you can list a few duties, and I would say take no more than 5 minutes. Again, I suspect if we really had to list all the duties, it could take quite a while. No, that's fine.
I don't even have my glasses.
Okay, that's all right. Well, before we go on and start sampling each other's wares, so to speak, I would like to talk a little bit about a little more human rights history. I suppose with Shoah and Schindler's List, most people are now aware of the historical fact of the Holocaust. And it is really after World War II that human rights becomes a formal political and moral discourse that the United Nations comes into being. And the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is drafted. One of the architects of that, Roncalli, became Pope John XXIII. And one of the other architects of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was Jacques Maritain, who was a Catholic theologian and ethicist. So that what you should realize is that even though we don't find the phraseology of human rights in the Bible, you've had Christians who have been very influential in the formation of the body of international law and morality that we call human rights. I would say, in my estimation, Catholics more than Protestants, although not everyone would agree with me in that regard. But I think it's clear that, in fact, you have had what one writer calls the triumph of human rights. That is, on a world stage, internationally speaking, when governments act, they act with the knowledge that they must be cognizant of and try and avoid violating human rights. So that human rights has triumphed as a moral idea on an international scene. And what you find is not the absence of human rights violations, but you find human rights violators who always go back to the notion of human rights and say, well, we didn't really violate this group or that group's human rights because we did this, that, and the other. And because we did that, we actually acknowledged their human right to A, B, C, D. Do you see what I'm saying in terms of the triumph of human rights? In other words, when a disaster occurs, when something perhaps genocidal occurs, people will say that, in fact, human rights were recognized rather than they were violated. Okay. You have, really, on the international scene, you don't have people saying anymore in a serious way that there are no such thing as human rights. That is being said by philosophers, but not by nation states. Having said that, who would like to share with me what they understand to be their duties?
I'll go first again.
Thank you.
I have three.
Generous person.
The first one, duty is the obligation to ensure that all people share equally in the world's abundance and are celebrated fully for the unique God-given creations that each person is. Two, the obligation to avoid conceit, arrogance, and privilege. And three, the obligation to always struggle towards a more perfect understanding of others.
Okay. It's a big obligations there.
Yeah, I know.
Okay. How about someone else?
It's not very fun to go after her.
Yeah. Well, I just wrote very simply, love your neighbor, but then I realized that everything, there's so much encompassed in under that. It's getting to know them and love them and being kind and everything to fall under that. That, if you really, really did that.
Okay, so you're one of these, since there's plenty of your folks, you go into the deeper meaning. What is the spirit behind the law? What is really the spirit behind those duties? Really loving your neighbor. Can't argue with that. I think you're right.
I've got to love God and one another and to be honest. Another and one's property and to trust one another. I don't write statements like she does.
It's okay.
I felt very good.
That was good,
to be honest.
Anybody else want to kick in?
I said to protect the sanctity of human life, to provide for basic human needs. I think it begins here. Food, shelter, clothing, and education I regard as a basic human need. Some of these are covered in the UN Declaration of Human Rights, I think.
Certainly are.
To do everything possible to treat people equally, regardless of race, religion, nationality, or gender. And to care deeply about those who suffer.
So you have a good motive. It's not just action, it's how you feel, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's what you do and also what you feel. Good. Okay, you don't have to if you don't want to.
But pretty much might have been said. Realize that all people are created in God's image and spread that word. Treat people how you'd want to be treated, love, respect, care, listen to, and treat everyone equally.
Good. Good. Now, the thing I did, and again, it's not a criticism of you, but what I noticed is folks didn't talk about invoking state powers as citizens specifically. Okay? And that's the thing about all rights, basically, of the moral and legal importance of human rights tend to involve the state. It is not just what you are willing to do as an individual. It is also what are you willing to do as an individual and as a citizen. And in a democracy, let's face it, we're stuck with the moral consequences of what a country does, because this is a democracy. because the government is considered to be our servants. See, we put them in office, we allegedly take them out of office. They're our servants. You know, in prior societies in which you had rulers and subjects, if a country did something that was morally repugnant, it was not necessarily the moral responsibility of the subjects. Okay? Because they don't have control. It's very difficult to say that in a democracy. Government are our servants. So, that is just a component I'd like you to think about. It's not retracting anything you said, but rather thinking about how you as an individual and as a citizen of the state, what duties perhaps might you need to do to get the state within which you are a citizen to recognize human rights? Which leads into this third question. Does our country recognize human rights? And I'm not going to ask you to write that one down. I know you get sick of all the writing, and it can be boring at times. I'm just going to poll you. What do you think?
I think it tries.
I think more often than not, our country recognizes property rights than it does human rights.
Okay. Anybody else? Well, if you wonder about that, there is an organization called Amnesty International, and it has a yearly report. It's a nonprofit organization that is dedicated to keeping tabs on the world in terms of the recognition and violation of human rights. And it reports every year to the world moral community who are the human rights violators and who are the people, or rather the countries and societies that uphold human rights. And of course, our country is always listed as violating some human rights. What do you think is the one that's cited so consistently in Amnesty International?
China. Right now, isn't it China?
Well, China is cited, but I meant what right do you think? We're cited for being violated about it. Didn't ask the question well.
Repeat it again.
What right do you think Amnesty International would list as greater as one of the violations that the U.S. consistently does? In other words, we're listed as a violator. Okay, you can all sit rights pass. What is it?
Well, it's still a racism in our country.
Yeah, but that's not what really hits Amnesty International directly. The one that it really lists is, of course, capital punishment. That's the one that they cite us so consistently for, and of course China also. Now, finally, controversy. I brought up a little lecture on capital punishment and decided not to give that one. But
could I say something about that?
Sure.
I'm a freedom writer for Amnesty International, and I noticed that we were asked to write letters on behalf of people who are imprisoned for their political beliefs in other countries. I don't think I've ever written one for someone in the United States.
Yeah. Well, that's true. And, you know, Amnesty International is Western, and it has been influenced very much by Western mores, including American ones. And yeah, the thing is, of course, Martin Luther King writes from a letter from a Birmingham jail in which clearly he is a political prisoner. Everybody, well not everybody, but most people believe that now. Obviously, most people didn't believe that then. And that's part of the problem with the issue of political prisoners. It is that they're put in jail precisely because they hold unpopular opinions and views. You know, later on, in fact, public opinion may change. Moral understanding and moral relations may change, and people might say, yes, Martin Luther King, fighting for civil rights, should never have been imprisoned. He was a political prisoner, and his human rights were violated, and we were wrong for doing so. But of course, most people didn't believe that at the time. Well, I'm not going to make an argument against capital punishment right now. I'm just saying that that is understood in terms of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as being a right that one is protected from. And that is, one has immunity, or should have immunity, is the argument. from capital punishment. Some people agree with that. I have members of my family who disagree with that. And of course, the issue that you raised is one I wrote my own dissertation for my doctorate on in terms of human rights. The United States, Jimmy Carter in 1976 signed the Covenant for Social, Economic, and Cultural Rights, which must be ratified by the United States government to be effective, and has never been ratified. So when you say, does our country recognize human rights, it seems to me the fairest answer is yes and no. Some we do, some we don't. Most of the international community does recognize, and most of the international community has not only signed but ratified the Covenant for Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. Well, what are those economic, social, and cultural rights? Let's just spend a few minutes on that. We have 37 to 40 million Americans who have no health care in this country. That is listed as an economic right in the Covenant. And most Western industrialized nations, I think aside for the U.S. and the Union of South Africa, in fact do have health rights as a right. Well, again, what are human rights? So we can debate this, whether health rights really are of a sufficient importance to be considered human rights. I argue in a 400-page dissertation that they are. Other people argue that they're not. It seems to me that I'm beginning to win. But we'll see, you know, the jury is still out. Well, what I want to do now is want to get into the last issue. Because what I want you to do is not think of human rights on one level as written on tablets. Moses comes down from Mount Sinai, and they're there for all time, in stone, in ways in which they can never be amended, they can never be understood differently. So I want to ask the question, what human rights claims are onerous, in your opinion, or false?
I guess, you know, nobody's said it yet, but running through the back of my mind is the Constitution about life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. But the way pursuit of happiness is construed oftentimes to mean amassing of wealth or enjoying a privileged lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's a real right when you're doing it at the expense of downtrodden people.
Okay, you have very good precedent for that point of view. You know, you have from Thomistic thought, Thomas Aquinas believed that there was always a social mortgage on any property, that the owner of any property had a right to its use and consumption up until the point where it was obvious that someone had, in terms of basic need, to survive, at which point the social mortgage would require the owner to lend or give the property to the needy person. So. And you can trace that back a lot further back than Aquinas. I don't have the time to do that now. But what I'm saying is there's a lot of people who have historically agreed with your position in terms of limits on property rights. At the same time, you have some people who believe that the only real rights are property rights. Others, what human rights claims do you find particularly to be bogus? Let me give you a hypothetical, try and stimulate your thoughts, perhaps. A husband and wife, married, doesn't matter which, either spouse does the cooking. And one spouse really likes orange marmalade on their toast. The other spouse knows that, but consistently makes their toast every morning. Won't put the orange marmalade on it, puts raspberry. Or grape or something other than what the other spouse desires. Well now, does the marmalade loving spouse have a right to it? In other words, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to impress upon you the issue of importance. And terms of rights talking. Let me take it back on the other end. John Kleinig, a writer in the human rights field, has taken the position that a rights claim, the allegation of a human right, the claiming of a human right, is not valid unless the interest that is being claimed is sufficiently important to the claimant to justify the use of fatal force. You see what I'm doing? What I'm doing is I'm trying to draw a continuum in terms of importance from Marmalade on one side to the justification of fatal force on the other. Somewhere along this continuum, the importance is sufficient to say that it's a human right. There were other rights, I think, in the first instance with the marmalade, that many of you want to stay married, put the orange marmalade on the toast. You know? it's just a kind of a common sense thing of a person who's been married for 19 years, you know. But we don't think of that as a right in a kind of strict, let's use fatal force on the other end, Eisenhower calling in the troops to move a governor out of the way to a school so it could be integrated. I mean, if George Wallace didn't move, then somebody might have gotten shot. Okay, that's the use of deadly force. So,
I'm thinking smokers and non-smokers.
Yeah, that's not real clear to me, though, because I don't know if you're speaking for the smokers or the non-smokers or both. I don't know.
Well, I, as a non-smoker, have the right. I feel that I don't have to breathe in the smoke of somebody else, but then somebody else feels he has the right to smoke, so.
And so you're bringing up one of the main issues in rights discourse, which is conflict of rights. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's the reason why I asked that question. Onerous or false? You feel then that a smoker might be making a false claim to a right. Right, to blow smoke in your face and shorten your lifespan. Okay? Other owners are false claims.
Thinking about a situation in our neighborhood that is bothering me, and that is that a group of young men who are renting the house across the street have set up more or less a mechanic shop in the garage without having any license, of course, to operate it, and the noise is continuous day and night, you know, into the late evening.
Okay.
With drills and hammers and this sort of thing. And I have a study at home and do a lot of my preparation for classes at home. So, you know, the noise is really bothering me. And I don't know if I have, I mean, it doesn't seem like a human right, but it seems like some sort of right. You know, there's definitely a conflict
of
interest there.
Yeah, I can say, even though I'm a retired attorney, I can say that you probably have a cause of action for something like a zoning violation.
But is that a human right?
Well, that's a good question. You know, that's a very good question. It certainly is a legal right, as in you could complain to the municipality, who would send an inspector out, see if they had a license, find them, perhaps enjoin them to close their shop. But that doesn't answer your question as whether or not that's a human right. You know, do we have a right to be free from noise? Well, again, I think a scale is helpful, you know. I think that owners of boomboxes have rights to play their music as loud as they want, as long as it's not near me, you know. And I don't begrudge them their right to enjoy whatever music it is. I do have a problem with people who want to, as you put it, invade to some extent your space and impose themselves upon me, what you might call conflict with with in their pursuit of happiness conflict with your pursuit of happiness. Well, I'm not getting very far with the notion of onerous or false claims. Let me try something out on you, though. Nancy Fraser, who's a very insightful ethicist, has talked about modern political discussion of discourse as being regarding political contests over the interpretation of human needs. And what I have done with her work is to suggest that, in fact, that's also what we do with human rights. That human rights, in fact, aren't fixed, but is, in fact, something we debate over. So that you have a debate that society needs to be protected from people who commit capital offenses, so that, in fact, you have arguments for capital punishment. At the same time, particularly internationally, you have arguments against capital punishment. You have arguments now with regards to the rights to a fair trial. When I was practicing law, constitutionally speaking, if you were a minority citizen, you did not have a right to have, for instance, if you were black, a black individual on your jury was constitutionally protected. Now, the exclusion of the jury box or the jury panel on the sole basis of race is not constitutional. You see that? In other words, what I'm saying is that what we have done with human rights is to use that as a form of discourse, of discussion, to essentially sort out our moral, social, and political relations. That's why I want to get away from the notion of Moses carrying the tablets off the mountain, that, you know, these human rights are there for all time. And so I think I'm going to talk a little bit more about how rights work, and then I want to talk about certain situations. Now, we know historically certain societies, for instance in the United States, ignored equal application of human rights. And in fact, although natural rights discourse was familiar with the European settlers of this country, because in fact rights analysis and discourse had taken place in Spain, the Spanish Civil War, and in Northern Europe, in terms of England had already had a Magna Carta before this. The New World was discovered, and in fact you had a number of rights claims settled before the New World was discovered. This country was founded essentially by a process of violating people's human rights, Native Americans, their rights to property, to the pursuit of happiness, were ignored. And in fact, their civilization was destroyed in the settlement of this country. And I think that's one of the reasons why.
I just have to interrupt you because I have to.